that. There are things. First, I want to give you a few pieces of information with respect to the course. It's 3 semester Wochenstunden and 1 SVS exercise. Therefore, you get 5 ECTS points. It's, as you already know, it's Mondays and Tuesdays. On Tuesdays, it's basically on the interim in on across the next building. The lecture will be in English. The material is in English. And what I will do is to use this teleteaching tool to do the recordings, but only of the audio and the drawing, and there's no video on it. And the lecture material, basically you can download it. You don't need any password or anything. Therefore, it's not on Moodle. It's on our own website. Therefore, in that sense, it's not protected or whatever. And it's a PDF, and you can print it as well as you can use it online. It has the links in it. It's planned that this will be the last time that the course will be provided. And therefore, we have the exams on... you have a regular scheduled exam sometime in July. Therefore, we don't know exactly when it will be, because the exact date will be determined by the Studiensekretariat. Therefore, it's not something that you can come to me and say, well, you would prefer this or that date. It's basically decided by the Studiensekretariat, and usually it will be sometime in July. And it's planned to have a repeat, re-exam, and that will be supposed to be then in October or something like that. It's the same procedure, as you know, from all the other courses: registration via TUM online with respect to the exam. The consultation, certainly Sprechstunde consultation, usually you can come to me after the lecture if you have some questions on Mondays or Tuesdays, or official hours will be on Mondays between 12 and 1 p.m. Or you can contact me via email, and then we could arrange a certain time and do the exercises. Oh, okay. I read Tuesday, but I thought that would be completely wrong. There will be exercises. It's once a week on Thursdays. It's on the other room around where the coffee machines are. And if you do the homework and if you have 70%, you get basically a grade bonus. The grade bonus refers to only to people who pass the exam. Therefore, in that sense, if you fail, you don't get a grade bonus and then pass it. I mean, it's only for people who pass the exam, and then if you get the grade bonus, you basically get 0.3, and therefore you might get strange grades which are not officially achievable. For instance, if you get in the exam 1.7, then you get a grade bonus of 0.3, then you would get a grade of 1.4. Usually you get grades 1.3, 1.7. And In the past, it was something like you basically hopped one grade level. That was changed by the university, that basically you would get 0.3 as a grade bonus. The organization, basically the exercises will be done by Frank Schütz, and you could also contact Wolfgang Wörndl, who sits just beside me, and you can also go and check with him if you have any questions. Let me check. No. That's it. Do you have any other questions? I mean, you can always interrupt if you have some questions or come to me.
So the grade bonus that you mentioned is only up to 0.3.
Yeah.
So it would be beneficial if we get a 1.3.
That's true. That's right. It's always, therefore, in that sense, it's if you get a 1.7, it's also 0.3, then you get the 1.4 as a grade. And therefore, it's always 0.3, except going from 4.3 to 4.0, because then you don't get the grade bonus. And here, the point is also that it's not just for the regular exam in July, but the grade bonus you would also get in the repeat. Therefore, in that sense, you don't lose it. And we would basically keep track of it, and then if somebody either fails on the original exam or due to sickness or whatever does not participate at the exam, then that person still gets the grade bonus. It doesn't lose it. Anything else?
You mentioned we will be able to copy the drawings while in the create internal screen. My question is, are they going to be published?
Yes. Ah, did you mean the recording?
No. You mentioned that we will be able to copy the drawings during the lecture to our brain.
Oh, do you mean to copy and write things? That will be, something like this. I would write things on it. It would also be in the recording in it. And therefore, it's not something which is lost. And therefore, you don't really have to copy it down. But it could be that you copy certain things down and then add additional information to it. And therefore, in that sense, the point is that it's not because now you see I'm basically now out of the drawing mode. It's the information is still there, and therefore, in what it's sometimes not as good for the presenter. That, for instance, if you write something down, go out of the drawing mode, and then comes a question. And then the things is gone. Then as a presenter, you start to draw down the whole thing again. Otherwise, if you would ask me now something, I could continue, go to the drawing mode, and then continue drawing again. And therefore, in that sense, it's more beneficial to the presenter to have the information also still there, because then you can really continue on to work with it. The other point is possibly to mention it. If there's still the stop sign, then I forgot to start the recording. And if you see that and notice that, then you could basically try to inform me that I forgot to start the recording. Because sometimes, stop is start, and it's just a reverse, but we know that from Windows already. That's he will basically arrange it. He will talk with you on coming Thursday, and how he arranges that. Certainly, the solutions will be posted after you are able to submit your solution. I mean, certainly. Certainly he will publish that, but I think you should contact him via email how to arrange that. Okay. And therefore I didn't want it to explain now how he wants to do the exercises, because he wants to present it himself, and therefore I don't really want to tell something, and then he wants to give slightly different information, and then you are somewhat confused what is now the correct mode, and therefore I try to basically let him the word, then he would basically provide all the information of it. I mean, the one thing, as I mentioned, if you have questions, you can always interrupt me, and then I can try to answer the questions of it, if I can do that immediately. And that's basically, if you go onto the teaching or Lehre side, then there's an entry for the course, and then you can basically download the information. And I can check with Fachschaft if in the past they also distributed the script for €1 as a fee for the printing fee. I can check that if they would do that again. Okay. The one things what I wanted to basically provide in the course are somewhat basic concepts with respect to design and implementation, and especially things which have an important role of it. And if you look at the way how we would go ahead and cover things, first we look at something like architectures of things, and there we would have look at communication mechanisms. Then we look at remote invocation. RPC stands for Remote Procedure Call. Therefore, in that sense, if we look more as a procedural language, here, if we have an object-oriented language, then we look at remote method invocation. Therefore, in that sense, it's basically the same thing as we had before with Remote Procedure Call, but only on a level of object-oriented. Design and concepts, there we have basically look at distributed transactions. Therefore, in that sense, if we have multiple servers involved, we can bundle multiple service requests and service answers and bundle them to a single transaction. And therefore, in that sense, we want to have either the all-or-nothing behavior, and we can see how that can be handled if multiple servers are involved. usually if you look at database systems, you have one database server, and then you have a transaction on one database server. And now we extend it into a distributed environment. Therefore, in that sense, we need some additional functionality to capture that. Therefore, we need some kind of a special coordination mechanism to handle that. And the other thing is also with locking, because now you have a locking across multiple servers to handle that. The other thing is what we handle here is also group communication in the sense of sending a message to a group of processes running on multiple machines, and now we have something like a serialization of the messages that they basically handled in the same order to avoid state confusion and state problems. Certainly, we look at web services. What are the concepts behind it? And there's also a part of it, the SOAP, as a way to handle that, or also use XML, RPC to transfer the information between client and servers. Distributed file service, there an important part is something like placement, where you place files, or we have copies of files, and there you might have then the problem of multiple update, and especially if you have multiple copies of the same file and you want, if you do a write, then all the copies have to be updated to have a consistent state of the file, because otherwise the file copies diverge. Therefore, in that sense, I don't really look at manual updates, as you can do that with regular file services. You can have multiple copies, and then you just copy things back and forth manually. That's not the case. What I want to look at it, it's basically we look at versions of it, how you can do that automatically. And there you have the major problem. If I also look at situations with respect to having copies on notebooks, and these notebooks might be disconnected for a certain time. And now you do a multiple update, your notebook is disconnected. How do you handle that? That you have something like an invalid or an outdated copy of the notebook, and then at a later time you get the update integrated into your environment. How do you notice that you have an outdated version of it? Basically, there's this CUDA file system which handles that, and it was at some point something like a competitive or competitor with NFS, but. And it was originally called the Andrew file system. And it's now especially targeted towards handling also disconnected situations. NFS handles basically immer all-time connected situations. Distributed shared memory, it's here we handle communication like synchronous interaction between client and server. Here we handle asynchronous situation between client and server. And then we also look at CORBA and .NET and things like that. Most of the things I already mentioned here, therefore we can make it very quick, this type. The only thing what I can mention here before is we look at a model of distributed application. And here, this happened before, and clocks for synchronization. We look at one hand, physical clocks. If you have a distributed environment, certainly every server has its own clock. And these clocks basically diverge sometimes quicker, sometimes less quick. And therefore, in that sense, you try to synchronize your physical clocks. You have these time servers, and now you try to resynchronize after a certain time. But you always, at some point, the clocks are out of sync. And we look at how to handle that. And also, we look at something like what we call these virtual clocks. Because sometimes we are not really interested that we have an exactly physical clock synchronization. We are completely satisfied with virtual clocks. And what we get then with that is something like event ordering. We use the virtual clocks to basically order events. And now we have a number of different servers and enough number of different clients. And the only thing what we require that every server, every client handles the events in the same order. And if the events are handled in the same order, then basically we can be certain that we have the same state in every computing environment. And therefore, in that sense, we don't really have to have this extensive physical clock synchronization. It's completely sufficient to check with the virtual clocks and have the virtual clocks basically in order, and then gives you the event ordering. The other thing is, with process groups, I already mentioned here, were distributed transactions. The commit we extend to a two-phase commit, and to handle multiple server involvements. Group communication, we can look at different types of multicast. There exists atomic multicast. There exists ordered multicast. There exists a whole variety of versions of multicast. And the point is that they are the effort is somewhat different. Like for certain multicasts, which gives you a very tight synchronization, it's very expensive. But it might be for your application, for your distributed application, you don't need that. Therefore, in that sense, it could be completely sufficient to have a much less strict synchronization, and then you would have something like a serialized multicast, and that's completely sufficient. And then you say, well, the effort to handle that, it's the overhead in sending messages back and forth would be much less, and therefore you might basically decide. Here, with information process groups, possibly here we look at group management and consistent message delivery. And we only look at process groups. And there exists a course like computer-supported cooperative work or social computing. There we look at group of people and check how groups of people can be synchronized with respect to coordination, workflow coordination, and things like that. Here we look only at process groups. Replication of information, here we talked about multiple update, concurrency control, and one is here we look at voting mechanism. That's for concurrency control. Web services, MDA, that's very short. That's very short. And at the end, we look at secure. And the only thing what is relevant for us, what we will look at, is authentication. And like you have an interaction between client and server, and they can authenticate each other. But we don't look at encryption of messages and things like that. Basically, there are a number of security courses by Professor Eckert, Professor Prechner, and you can basically, I don't really want to repeat all these things, what we have here. Therefore, in that, okay, yeah. Authentication and Kerberos. Okay. Bibliography. The one thing is there are a number of things in it in the book of Gloris, Dollimore, Kindberg, and Blair. And there's also a website for references and additional information. There are also some questions directly related to the course. There are no solutions on it. If you want to have there's a German version of the book from the previous version of it. This is a newer instance from 2 years ago. Then there's also the two books from Tannenbaum. And the other books here, they are somewhat... There are the other books which basically cover certain parts of it, like reliable distributed systems, SOA, service-oriented modeling. We cover that SOA also, but also mashups, we cover that also. And usually tell you that for the exam, the script is actually sufficient. And you can look at the books to get some in-depth information. If you say, well, here that was covered only partially with respect to the topic, you can look at the books. Usually, certainly in the books, they have 800, 900, 1,000 pages. That's not really able to cover that completely in the course. Therefore, we pick certain things out of it, and it's covered in more detail. Okay. The other thing is I have something like a list of abbreviations. It's not complete, but, well, it's supposed to give you some idea. I mean, all the abbreviations are not as bad as it in computer networks. In computer networks, you usually have a lot more abbreviations, but I mean that's the case. Here, the issue is in the introduction. We have something like motivation. We talk about basic terminology, especially the terms distributed application and interfaces, and also what I wanted to look at some influential systems. And it's not a complete coverage. It's only some, like NFS, like MUC, J2E, and also I talk a little bit about GUI and how they arrange it. And just I don't cover it all the systems completely, just I pick out certain things which had an influential impact on distributed applications. From the background, we can look at it. How did it arrange? And if we can think of it, a long time ago, we had early on something like production flow in manufacturing. And what we had here is something like job scheduling. And early you had it on the conveyor belt, that you had this this flow, production flow. Then at some point later came this money flow with respect to banks, that you had the very quick transfer of money. And then later on came basically what we call now this information flow. And if you look at it, it basically started with a whole web situation. And especially then later on, it started with the possibility that this participation of people. And before, you had information flow from a few information provider and then many information consumers. And now you have this basically participation situation. Everybody can be a provider. Everybody can be a consumer. And therefore, you have a new situation of information flow, especially which started then in the 2000s with the social computing situation. And the information flow, you have on one hand the situation of intra-organizational and also the information flow basically inter-organizational between the organizations. And if you look at the history of the whole things in the 50s, specialized applications, isolated data, then numerical applications, then came more this time sharing applications and commercial applications with data modeling, and COBOL was an important language. And I mean, there are still a number of applications out there which use COBOL programs. Then in the 80s with the Macintosh, yes. Time sharing, it's what you had. You have a one system, you have a number of terminals, and people could log in and basically use more or less at the same time the system. That you have, before what you had here with batch, you had these punch cards. And you specified your job. Then you went to a machine, which basically the punch card reader, which read in your punch cards, generated the processes. Then you basically had your machine to your own, and it executed all the processes, process, sub-process from your job. And then when it finished, the next job was read in, and it's more or less you always had the machine on your own. With time sharing, you basically at the same time there were multiple people on the machine, but you still did not have your own machine. Here you had your own machine. It's with your desktop environment, and therefore, in that sense, personal workstations, and also you had servers to exchange things. Desktop publishing came then in the 80s and isolated data. And at the beginning, you did not have an easy way of exchange. Then came networking here in the 90s. And also it came multimedia. And I remember in the early 90s, they said, well, all the video stores would basically go bankrupt. Everybody would download things and look at the videos. And if you look at it, basically the video stores still exist, and now slowly the video downloads basically come, and you could share videos and download it and watch it on your own on the computer or on the TV. But also in the early 90s, they said that already. And they had all these experiments. And it was interesting then later on, there were all these companies spreading up in California, in Florida, and so on. And then they did some usage tests. And then basically they found out they had no paying customers. The only customers who used all this video service were basically the employees of the companies. And then all these companies basically went defunct. And because what was missing at that time was these high performance servers, which could handle multiple video streams at the same time, because they wanted to support UCOM 5 minutes or 10 minutes later. Another one wants to say watch the same movies. And 5 minutes later, another one came. And now we talk about hundreds of people. They could handle that. And the second problem was the network bandwidth. They couldn't handle that. And now if you look at it, they have the possibility. Then came in the 2000s, the internet computing with web services and so on. And now you can look at it. And you would have something like cloud computing, and you have providers like Amazon, like Microsoft, Dropbox, and so on, providing things. It it somewhat had a little bit of a bad, press in a way with all the NSA problems that basically NSA got all the access to the cloud environments, and then also look at all the content and so on. And therefore, in that sense, well, will be interesting how it will develop in the future. If we look at the internet computing, I mean, I have here a few examples in a sense of that, first of all, what with internet computing, you want to share resources, and the other thing is you want to communicate. And the third important aspect is to coordinate activities. These are the three important aspects. And examples, online flight reservation, that exists already for quite some time. If you look at it, you have actually not really many providers to do on-flight reservation. There's one Sabre in the U.S., there's Amadeus here in Europe, and there are very few actually on-flight reservations environment which handle them basically for all the airlines. The other thing is distributed money machines, And they basically, the money machines in the early days, they were not really tightly connected. They basically just got an update once a day, and now they are really tightly connected. Therefore, if you get a limit of like 500 euro per day to deduct, and you immediately go to the next machine and try to deduct, the next machine already knows that you already deducted the money. Other part, audio-video conferencing, net meeting is with shared applications. You have Skype, where you can share audio, share data, and so on. Grid computing, there are two approaches, like the high-performance machines, which can share, and also the LRZ is part of a large grid computing center here. I don't know if you know heard of this, is SETI approach, which basically is not really active anymore, but it's unofficially active, and the important part of it, they wanted to search for extraterrestrial intelligence if they find signals in worldwide space, to find if there is some kind of radio signals and find that out. And it ran for a long time, and it basically used all the environments and all the machines in the off times. The the other things is social software with blogs, Flickr, YouTube, Facebook. And the other things is, which basically is a newer things with this massive multiplayer online games. And the important part is here the fast response, the fast response times, because, I mean, if you look at games, you need a very quick response. And there are two major approaches to handle that. The one is a centralized approach, like EVE Online, which basically, which is something like a replicated online server, and a centralized server, which basically coordinates everything, and therefore it tries to have the messages rather short. And the other approach is to have more like a peer-to-peer approach. And therefore, in that sense, you don't have a centralized server. It's a more like a decentralized approach. And now you try to coordinate the whole thing. And it's with this response, that's really a major thing, what this requirement you don't really have on all the other things is. And because, I mean, if you use in a 3D world, try to move around and have other partners or elements or components coming around the corner, you have to do that very quickly. Okay, here I want to stop, and tomorrow we would then basically come a little bit about enterprise computing and then continue on the content. Thank you very much.